You're listening to the Biographics Podcast. This is an episode that originally aired on YouTube, so there used to be a visual element. There is not anymore. This is just for your listening pleasure. Maybe you're out walking the dog or driving the car where it's not so easy to watch the video version. This is why this audio version exists. If you like us doing this, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. We really do appreciate it, and let's get into this episode.
John D. Rockefeller was a businessman who amassed one of the largest fortunes in history. He controlled 90% of the oil in the country, and at the time of his death, he was worth between $300 and $400 billion. Today, the name Rockefeller is synonymous with wealth for this very reason, and his legacy has lived on long after his death. Today on Biographics, we tell the story of how a seemingly ordinary boy grew up to be the most powerful man in the United States. John D. Rockefeller was born on July 8, 1839 in Richford, New York. His mother, Eliza Davidson, had a total of six children. His father, William Avery Rockefeller, called himself a traveling botanic physician. This might sound impressive, but this was actually just a fancy name for a snake oil salesman. His father earned the nickname Big Bill for his larger-than-life personality. These types of salesmen knowingly sold fake products to people promising that their so-called elixirs could cure practically anything. They were usually charismatic showmen who truly knew how to get people so excited about a product that they were practically begging to give their money away. While Big Bill was traveling across the country, essentially stealing money from unsuspecting victims, he would spend some time in each town before catching the next train. He started a double life with a woman named Nancy Brown and had children with her. Despite being so good at his job, Big Bill always seemed to struggle with money, and there never seemed to be enough to go around when he came back to visit Eliza and their six children. John D. Rockefeller was raised by his father to never trust anyone. Big Bill opened his arms to catch John when he was still just a toddler, but when the boy jumped, his father stepped back and let him fall on the floor in order to teach him a lesson. Bill would also trick John and his brothers by making promises he never intended to keep just so he could get them to do extra chores. Big Bill once said, "I cheat my boys every chance I get. I want to make them sharp." John Rockefeller was the oldest son in his family, so he was the man of the house when his father was gone. As a child, he would help his mother raise turkeys in their backyard so that they could sell the meat. They did odd jobs for neighbors, and for the most part, they were forced to fend for themselves without much help from their father. At one point, Bill decided to come clean to both of his wives and revealed that he was splitting his time between two different households. He suggested that they all move in together as one big happy family. This was bigamy, of course, but it was not illegal in the United States at the time. The Moral Anti-Bigamy Act was passed in 1862 after polygamy became more prevalent among members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But the Rockefellers, they weren't part of the LDS Church. Now, he must have truly been a smooth talker, because he somehow convinced both Eliza and Nancy to agree to a sister-wives situation. The family, they moved to Cleveland, Ohio, and they told their neighbors that Nancy Brown was their live-in housekeeper. Rockefeller was disgusted by his father's behavior, and he swore that he would never grow up to become that kind of man. He decided to save his money and never waste it on frivolous things. He also became very devoutly religious in the Baptist Church and held himself to a high moral standard. This difficult family situation was most likely why he chose to start working as quickly as possible so that he could move out and start an independent life away from his parents and his father's mistress. He often said that his goal was to make $100,000, which is the equivalent of about $3 million today, and live to be 100 years old. Rockefeller attended Cleveland Central High School, but he did not want to wait until after graduation to become a businessman. So he dropped out of high school and took just one business and accounting class at Folsom Mercantile College. This was enough experience to get him a job as an assistant bookkeeper for a local merchant called Hewitt and Tuttle on September 25, 1855, when he was only 16. He gained a lot of valuable experience at this job, but the only trouble was that his bosses only paid him 50 cents a day. Even after inflation, that's still only $13.36, which was nowhere near enough to make a full-time living. Even though they weren't paying him much, Rockefeller was always extremely proud of the day that he got his first job. He made September the 25th into his own holiday called Job Day and celebrated the anniversary every year for the rest of his life. Luckily for Rockefeller, he had been friendly with the customers at Hewitt and Tuttle. This gave him a great reputation around town. He was always paying close attention to how everything worked, and he eventually learned all of the skills necessary to start his own business. Since everyone in town knew him, he managed to get a $4,000 loan, which is worth over $100,000 today. This was more than enough money to start trading in goods like hay, meat, and grain. His business, it managed to earn him $450,000 in the very first year. Now, he didn't get to keep that money for himself, of course, because a lot of it had to go back into repaying the loan and business expenses, but this was a great start to what would be a long and prosperous business career. John said, "God gave me money," and he did not apologize for it. In 1861, the United States broke out into civil war, and Rockefeller felt very strongly about being an abolitionist. Rockefeller's younger brother, Frank, became wounded very early in the war. When John was drafted, he actually paid a professional soldier to go in his place. That way, he was able to continue running his business and contribute to the war effort at the same time. He said, "I wanted to go in the army and do my part, but it was simply out of the question. There was no one to take my place. We were a new business, and if I had not stayed, it must have stopped." Believe it or not, this was actually a common practice back then, at least for the men who could afford it. And by staying home, he was also able to profit by selling supplies for the war effort. Today, the oil industry is concentrated in the Middle East, but back then, it was heavily concentrated in the US. In 1849, a man named Samuel Keir discovered crude oil on his property in Titusville, Pennsylvania. By the 1850s and 60s, word spread, which caused a huge boom known as the Pennsylvania Oil Rush. Men were moving to Pennsylvania, hoping to strike it rich by setting up oil rigs and tapping the ground for their liquid black gold. At that time, people needed oil for their lamps in order to see at night. The only alternative was to process oil from whale fat, but taking it from the ground was obviously a much easier process. However, the crude oil that's found in the ground does need to be refined before it can be used by a consumer. Crude oil was being transported by train from Pennsylvania to various oil refineries around the country. John D. Rockefeller had the brilliant idea of taking advantage of this rush by building an oil refinery in Cleveland, Ohio. He was 24 years old at this point, and he had decided that instead of continuing to be a merchant, he should devote all of his time and energy to growing his new oil business. Rockefeller, he was still very frugal, so he tried to save money by cutting out the middlemen whenever possible. Instead of buying wooden barrels from a third-party company, he bought thousands of acres of land so that his employees could cut down trees and make the barrels themselves. In 1870, he met a man called Henry M. Flagler, who was interested in investing in Rockefeller's business. Together, they incorporated the Standard Oil Company. With Flagler's help, Rockefeller began to buy up all of the smaller oil refineries in the Cleveland area so that he no longer had any competitors. Whenever any refinery refused to sell their company to him, Rockefeller would begin selling his oil at a loss so that customers would flock to him instead of the competition. This would simply put the smaller companies out of business. But he didn't stop there. Standard Oil began to spread to other states, and soon enough, they were refining 90% of America's oil. He was now a millionaire. At this point, the company was so huge it was impossible for one man to oversee the operations of the entire country. Therefore, he decided to allow the former heads of the oil companies he purchased to become his new board of trustees. This created a super squad of the smartest oil experts in the country, and he made himself the head of this so-called trust. This sounds typical for large companies today who put a CEO as the figurehead, but back then this kind of empire, it was unheard of, and Rockefeller was setting the stage for other American businesses as a leading example of how to acquire wealth and power. In the 1800s, railroads were helping to aid America through the Industrial Revolution. For the first time in history, large cargo could be shipped across the country at record speeds. By the 1860s, the two biggest businesses in the United States were the railroads and oil. So it only made sense that Rockefeller wanted to be involved in both of them. He was actually plotting to create a railroad trust and do exactly what he had done with the oil businesses. He was already cooperating with the Vanderbilt family, and he was going after the owners of various railroads in order to purchase their stock and strike deals with the presidents of each one. Rockefeller needed to be on good terms with railroads because he needed them to transport his barrels of oil by train. Since he had such a massive quantity of product, he negotiated with the Pennsylvania Railroad to get a discounted rate on shipping. At first, this was working out really well, and the Pennsylvania Railroad went on a spending spree to expand the railroad. Before long, the discount they gave Rockefeller was no longer enough to cover their costs, and it would potentially bankrupt the company. So they had to go back on their promise and raise the price. Instead of giving in, Rockefeller responded by laying his own underground pipelines, and he reached out to work with other railroad companies. Now, the Pennsylvania Railroad had just lost their biggest client and their main source of income. In 1877, the Pennsylvania Railroad started building their own oil refinery so that they could put their trains to good use. After all, the oil industry was their bread and butter, whether it came from Rockefeller or not. Since Rockefeller felt entitled to control all of the oil, he was outraged. He stormed in to speak with the executives of the railroad, saying, "Why, it is nothing less than piracy." To make matters worse, the railroad employees began to strike across the nation because they were not getting paid. This became known as the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. They finally buckled under the pressure and sold their oil refinery to Rockefeller for $3.4 million. 10 years later, the U.S. government would pass the Interstate Commerce Act, which forced regulations on the prices charged by railroads. This prevented those companies from gouging the price for transportation. From an outsider's perspective, people did not see a railroad that broke a contract. They saw Rockefeller as the villain. People believed that he had far too much power. Everyone could see the writing on the wall. If Rockefeller was not stopped, he may take over the railroad industry completely, and after that, there would be no stopping him from taking more and more until there was nothing left for anyone else. The general public strongly disagreed with Rockefeller's tactics, and they believed that he was like a shark gobbling up smaller businesses. It had already happened in the oil industry, and he was making moves in the railroad industry as well. People were terrified that he would eventually be so rich and powerful that he might just take over the world. Newspapers, they bashed Standard Oil, and political cartoons featured Rockefeller on a regular basis. Even President Teddy Roosevelt was very vocal about being antitrust and promised Americans that he was going to do something to stop it. The state of Ohio planned to create new antitrust laws specifically to stop Rockefeller and Standard Oil from having a monopoly over the entire industry. Since it was only a state law at that point, Rockefeller was able to reincorporate in New Jersey in 1882 before they even had a chance to sue him. He opened his new headquarters on Broadway in New York City. Reincorporating in another state did not protect him for long, though, because in the year 1890, U.S. Congress passed the Sherman Antitrust Act, which made it illegal in every state. 2 years later, the Supreme Court declared that Standard Oil was violating this new law. So, how did Rockefeller deal with dissolving his monopoly? Well, he didn't. He just figured out a legal loophole. The Board of Trustees, they divided up Standard Oil amongst themselves and created smaller companies so that technically they would no longer be considered a monopoly. In 1899, these new companies were all brought back under the umbrella of Standard Oil. These are called subsidiaries, which is when a small company is under the control of a larger corporation. Just a few examples of these smaller companies were BP, Exxon, ConocoPhillips, and Chevron. These companies all around to this very day. At that time, there was a group of writers and journalists called muckrakers, and they took it upon themselves to uncover corruption in American businesses. One such journalist, Ida Tarbell, wrote a book in 1904 called The History of the Standard Oil Company, where she went through the story of Rockefeller's ruthless rise to power. She wrote, "Rockefeller and his associates did not build the Standard Oil Company in the boardrooms of Wall Street banks. They fought their way to control by rebate and drawback, bribe and blackmail, espionage and price-cutting by ruthless efficiency of organization." Tarbell is remembered for being one of the most successful investigative journalists of her time, and many credit her and the other muckrakers with helping to dismantle the Rockefeller monopoly. But of course, people in the general public, they didn't realize that these new oil companies were not small business making a comeback. Rockefeller, of course, was still pulling the strings, and for him, a rose of another name was just as sweet. Even though there is plenty of information out there about the financial success of John D. Rockefeller, he was a fiercely private person, and he tried his best to keep his family life out of the newspapers. What we do know is that when he was 25 years old in 1864, he married a woman named Laura Spelman. She was a devout Christian who worked as a schoolteacher, and they were very much in love with one another. He said of her, "Her judgment was always better than mine. Without her keen advice, I would be a poor man." He wrote her beautiful love letters when he had to travel for business. He once wrote, What a blessing that I have such a good and true wife. How much I would give for wings to reach you tonight. All of this romance led to the creation of their children, Elizabeth, Alice, Alta, Edith, and John Jr. Sadly, Alice died during infancy. Even though he was very busy, he always made time to be with his family. He was a loving father and a devoted husband who never took them for granted. Now, all his life, Rockefeller had a very impressive mustache, but during the 1890s, he began suffering from a condition called alopecia. He began to lose all of the hair on his entire body, including his eyebrows. At first, he tried to hide it by wearing toupees, but as he grew older, he decided to let people see him in public after he had lost all his hair. In the 1990s, a biographer named Ron Chernow got permission from the Rockefeller family to write a biography. He learned by speaking to his children and grandchildren that Rockefeller never spoke much about his father, and he never allowed Big Bill to be a part of their lives. They also never met his half-sisters, and they were never given any of the fortune because Rockefeller did not consider them to be a part of his real family. After digging through a mountain of paperwork, Ron Chernow finally found William Avery Rockefeller's grave in a small cemetery in Freeport, Illinois. He was buried under an alias called Dr. William Levingston. It would seem that even in death, John D. Rockefeller wanted the memory of his father to be entirely forgotten. In 1897, John D. Rockefeller chose to retire from his position at Standard Oil and left the control of the business to his board of trustees and his son, John D. Rockefeller Jr. In 1911, Standard Oil was sued once again for violating the Antitrust Act, and they were forced to split up into dozens of different corporate entities. But he decided to invest in all of these new companies, and ironically, it only made him more money on the stock market. Estimates on Rockefeller Sr.'s true net worth vary, anywhere from $300 to $400 billion. And to give that some perspective, the founder of Amazon.com, Jeff Bezos, who is currently the richest man in the world today, is only worth $100 billion. Only. It's probably not a coincidence that Bezos also practiced the same exact method that Rockefeller once did, buying out smaller online bookstores during the expansion of Amazon.com. Now, most people, they try to vilify John D. Rockefeller, but he wasn't bad. He believed in the Christian tradition of tithing, so he had been giving a portion of his income to charity since he was 16 years old. He gave $70 million towards the founding of the University of Chicago, and he also helped create the Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, which was an all-black women's school. According to the New York Times, Rockefeller gave away $550 million in charitable donations to scientific research, education, as well as the Baptist Church. Rockefeller became well known in his later life for the practice of giving dimes to adults and nickels to children wherever he went. He even gave dimes as a playful gesture to wealthy men such as tire mogul Harvey Firestone. One of the best examples of his generosity also doubled as his legacy. In the year 1930, Americans were suffering after the Great Depression. John D. Rockefeller was already in his 90s, so he decided to use a huge chunk of his fortune to build the Rockefeller Center in New York City. It was called a city within a city because it had dining, shopping, apartments, and even a movie studio. The project created 40,000 new jobs during construction, and people were gainfully employed once all of the businesses inside the center were open. The project was completed in 1933, and today the Rockefeller Center has become an iconic part of Manhattan, especially during Christmas time. Biographer Ron Chernow wrote of Rockefeller, "What makes him problematic and why he continues to inspire ambivalent reactions is that his good side was every bit as good as his bad side was bad. Seldom has history produced such a contradictory figure." John D. Rockefeller died just 1 year after completion of his center in 1934. He often told people that his goal was to live to be 100 years old, but he didn't make it past 97. Perhaps the best way to summarize his life was a poem Rockefeller wrote himself at age 86. "I was early taught to work as well as play. My life has been one long, happy holiday, full of work and full of play. I dropped the worry on the way, and God was good to me every day."
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode of the Biographics Podcast. Leave us a review. Why not? You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or a rating, or however these things work. I like reading them. It makes me feel good when they're positive. It lets me know what you don't like when they're negative. Also, if you want to say hi, say let me know how I'm doing with this podcast, just drop me an email. It's simon@biographics.org. Biographics spelled the same way that the name of this podcast is spelled. So again, that's simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email, say hi, let me know how you like this podcast. And as always, I'll see you next time.